Hi, I'm Jen Sherlock, and welcome to my lifestyle podcast, Live Without a Net. The podcast showcases people who live fearlessly and have the ambition to create something. I'll showcase change makers who have decided to let go of their safety net in order to survive. So let's jump right in. Hi, I'm Jen Sherlock. Welcome to Live Without a Net. I'm with Stephen Seymour. He's the owner and broker of VRA Realty. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Jen, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Of course. So tell me about your whole career. When did you start getting into buying homes and just getting involved in all kinds of real estate?
Well, it really goes back to my childhood, and my dad was a builder. So by the time I was 18, I had already been exposed to working in the construction field with my dad since I was a little kid. And not that I was his employee, but just being around that business all the time and helping him out on little projects, I learned so much. So that's really that's what started it. And my dad always encouraged me to get into rental properties. I'm super, super grateful for everything he taught me. He actually passed in 2022, but he was really the catalyst for it.
I'm sure he's looking down and proud of you. So when you were younger, of course, when you were younger, you just kind of soaked in everything around you on different construction projects to learn all sides of the business.
Yeah. I mean, I think we learn, we learn how to walk by watching people walk. Right. And so a lot of times we think we learn from school or from books, but I think we learn the most from experience and just physically being around that whole construction world for such a long period of time. You know, it was kind of baffling to me that people didn't know what that metal box in their basement was when they're referring to their heater. You know, it's kind of, it's
right.
A lot of people don't see the studs behind the walls and the wires and where things go. And it was just kind of natural for me from watching it for so long. You understand how something's built.
Yeah, I agree. Even when I went to Villanova before I got into TV reporting, like it was from my internships I learned what to do, but not from school. I know that sounds bad, but I definitely learned the most through my internships. So it's similar, like you learn by doing, I guess.
Yeah, being in it.
Right, because that's the way you kind of, at least me, you know, by doing it and going through the motions, it helps get in my brain. And then therefore I just learn along the way. But I guess some people are different. Some can probably be more visual, I guess, and just read about it, but not me. Doesn't sound like you either.
So from being around the construction and him encouraging me to get into rental properties, my dad was a builder, but he always said, you know, the money's made in the buy and hold in the rental properties long-term. And he put that in my brain at a pretty young age. He didn't really have a big rental portfolio. He had just a few, but even that really helped him later on in his career. And, but that sparked my interest. I got licensed in 2006 and I worked at Long & Foster, a traditional real estate brokerage, had a great team leader, learned the whole sales thing. But really, you know, sometimes you go a certain direction and you forget why you got into it in the first place, which was really to learn how to buy rental properties and create the long-term wealth. So being at a brokerage with over 140 agents, I eventually got to the point where I was looking around. There was really no one that I looked up to in terms of going that pathway. And luckily, I was so lucky, I got involved with an organization called DIG, Diversified Investor Group, and it's a nonprofit around real estate education for investors. And that was a big gap because the things that we were learning at the real estate brokerage, not that it's not valuable to make a living, but it wasn't teaching us that wealth pathway of actually buying rentals and how to use creative financing and structure deals and raise capital and renovate properties and all the stuff that actually needs to happen to get started in that. So with DIG, I got connected with some great mentors, and that really shifted the focus from the sales to the investing side.
So how big is your portfolio now?
It's just about 20 million in assets with approximately 70 units. And that's a mixture of residential, multi-tenant. I have some retail mixed use. I also have some office space.
Okay. So what's hot right now in 2025? I know like a year or so ago, people or real estate developers, I should say, were looking for warehouses. I mean, what is it? What is it now? Is it the same? They're looking to turn warehouses into
Well, the funny thing is, Jen, and I don't mean to derail you, but you're asking the wrong question.
Okay. No, it's okay.
I'll tell you why.
Okay.
This is how everyone thinks.
Okay.
You know, what's the next hot stock I should buy? What's the next hot this, right? And everyone jumps. Right. And then you never really get good at anything. And I'm not saying that's like 100%, but my take on it is, like, if my strategy is buy and hold long term, the game I'm actually playing is financial arbitrage. And I'm just using real estate as a vehicle for that. And not to say that I don't want to look for deals and do, you know, transactions that are very profitable. Mm-hmm. But when I look for something that's hot, that's just the trend waiting to fall into the past, right?
Okay. You know,
and big long-term investors, if you interview enough real estate investors, they'll all say, buy and hold long term, right? I'm not looking for the get rich quick. And anyone that's listening to this, if they're trying to get it out of the podcast, it's not going to happen. Real estate's get rich slow, but it's a very guaranteed route. I don't want to say guaranteed, can't use that, but a very proven methodology to create wealth by borrowing money and paying it back with money that's worth less over time based upon the purchasing power of the dollar. So I'm just using real estate as a vehicle that you can get really great debt terms on. And obviously they're not as good as they were, but not to say that there's not ups and downs, but my point being, when an asset class is hot, guess what? The price is high. When asset class is low, the price is low. So an example is my office buildings, 10,000 square feet. I bought that just a few years back for $60 a square foot for $600,000. In Westchester, Pennsylvania, $60 a square foot is, you know, that's, you can't get anything for that kind of price. So it's not about what type of asset class is hot. Now, I think it is important to niche down and understand your asset classes. I bought that as an owner user, not as an investor, but I do rent out spaces. I think it's more important. The question to ask is, you know, what is a niche that you're passionate about, that you believe in? There's market demand and it's sustainable over a longer period of time if your strategy is buy and hold. And with that said, I like multifamily. Mm-hmm. I like multi-tenant flex space.
Okay.
And I like mobile home parks. And that's the focus. The reason that I'm going in that direction is because you can typically purchase an asset that has cash flow day one.
Okay.
And that minimizes your risk. You can also have you can purchase properties that will have a value add. So meaning you can take something and create value. Now you can do that in any asset class, but it's more predictable in these asset classes. For example, if you go in and I just bought a 16 unit apartment building.
Okay.
A lot of the rents were between, I think the lowest one was 750. Between like 750, 1100, the market rents are between 1500 and some of them possibly even over 2000. So I'm going in and I'm adding value instantly, right? But there is immediate cash flow that helps cover the debt and then drive the cash flow up, which increases the net operating income. And therefore, you know, now you're driving the value of the building up, but I also believe there's a long-term demand for housing in the area that I purchased the building in. So you're kind of looking for a few different things in a deal with the strategy that I'm employing, which is value add, long-term hold. I could be doing that flip and that would be a little different.
Okay. Do you want to talk about that first? Because then I was going to ask you about like where people borrow from, but we can talk about the flip if you want first, since that's a value add.
No, I would actually rather go into your other question about where the biggest question is like, where do you get the money from, right?
Right.
And I'll break down the last two deals that I did and just kind of give you an example of where I'll do the last three, actually. Last 6 months, I bought about $5.3 million in real estate on three transactions, utilizing basically none of my own money. And when I say basically, I'll explain the last part because I don't like to use vagueness, but the first one, it was none of my own money. It was a duplex and it was owned by an investor that I know who purchased it. And he got a little worn out with the tenant and the leaky roof and all that. And he had just renovated it. He had only recently purchased it and he purchased it in a single member LLC. private money loan with the intention to refinance it into a long-term loan. So he had gotten 100% financing from the private money lender. And when he was looking at doing the refi, he just said, you know what, Steve, if you can buy me out of this and get me out where I have no money in it, I'm fine with it. I just want to wash my hands. So I looked at it. This was not really like an equity play. It was more just long-term getting an asset in my name for next to nothing. And I just went to the private lender and I was like, are you okay if we do a subject to deal, meaning sell the property? It's really like a subject to, but the way we structured is a little slightly different. But we left the debt in the private lender's name. I became the owner, but I became the owner of the LLC, not the property. So the property wasn't even really transferred, so to speak. But the private lender was notified that the ownership, the control was taken over. And then as soon as that was in place, then I took my personal financial statement, my credit score, went to a local bank. And we did what's called a DSCR loan. And a DSCR loan is a debt service coverage ratio loan. And the bank said, okay, there's enough rental income that we'll lend you enough to pay off the private lender.
Okay.
So this was a true no money out of pocket deal because the assignment of membership interest was just to sign over the LLC. The refinance, I increased the loan amount just enough to cover the closing costs. This was about $500. It was $500,000 purchase. I think I, you know, refinanced it at $520. True no money in deal. Can you see me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. His computer just popped up. Something was that?
Okay.
Sorry, we're dealing with some technical.
Oh, it's okay because I can.
And Jen, I'm sorry if I go off on a rant. I use a lot of lingo and terminology.
No, it's interesting. I'm like writing this down because I've never heard of what you just said. You said subject to and DSCR loan. I've never heard of that, but it's okay. People can Google it, just like I'm going to Google it.
So basically, to recap, the LLC was transferred. The LLC owned the property. That was transferred. Okay. The ownership was transferred to me. The existing debt from the private lender stayed on that LLC and the property until I went to a local bank, refinanced it, and then paid off that private lender. Well, now, the previous owner, he's no longer member of the LLC. I own 100% of it. And guess what? The private lender was paid back. And now I have fixed for the next 5 years, debt on it, and it cash flows. So that's a nice little way to get a duplex. Then now I'll fast forward to the next one. This was a same town, Westchester, PA, which is a very desirable area. And I won't say this is an A-class building, but it's more than a B+. It's maybe an A-.
Okay. And
the previous owner, he actually renovated it. He renovated it for 4 years. It was a long project. He took a single-family house, converted it into a 5-unit building. It's essentially 4 residential units, 1 large commercial space that could be broken up into 3 units, actually. So it could be between 5 and 7. But the way I structured this deal was, this was actually his retirement plan. And he got burned out with all the construction on it over time. And eventually was like, you know what? I need to get out of this. He had an investor that put up money and she wanted the money back out. So he took so long on the project that at the end of it, it was almost just like he needed a fresh start, right? But he had just finished it. So I didn't need to renovate it. I didn't really need to do anything other than lease it up. And there was already a few tenants in place. But what I did is I actually had a relationship with his commercial lender that had lent him the money on it. And I went to that same bank because they're already familiar with the project. And they had actually given him multiple notices like, hey, you're past your construction loan. You need to do something with this. So there was motivation from the bank. There was motivation from his side. And knowing this, I had a conversation with the seller. I said, how about you sell it to me? I'll get a new loan with that existing bank. You take back a second position mortgage for my down payment and closing costs, essentially, right? And maybe I used a little different terminology when I'm presenting it to him, but that's essentially what he did. So that same bank that had the loan on it, they originated a new loan for me the purchase price of the property is $1.6 million. They lent me $1,030,000, which was 70% loan to value. And that was their underwriting criteria. The seller took back a $480,000 second mortgage, which brought me up to 97.5% financing. And then I was able to charge him a 6% commission as a broker. And it was all packaged in the sale price, and he was fine with it. But that was a $95,000 commission that I rolled into the transaction to pay all of my transfer tax, title insurance, closing costs, and my 2.5% down. But anyone listening to this will know, typically you have to put down 25% on a commercial mixed-use retail space like this. So, you know, I was able to get the bank to do that from a few reasons. And stop me if you have any questions, because I know I just went through a lot. And the questions might be the same questions your listeners have. But the big picture point is, we think we need 25% down to do a commercial deal. You don't, right? And obviously, I had to negotiate with the bank. They wanted me to initially put 10% skin in the game. I went back. I said no. They came back. They said 5%. You know, they wanted me to have 5% in. I said no. It's a great deal. You know, you already know the project. You know the debt on this. It's going to cover it. And that they came back and they were like, the lender was like, Steve, can you please just put like 2.5% in on this deal? And I was like, sure. Knowing in the background, I'm charging a 6% commission, which was covering the whole thing. So long story short is, I actually walked out of settlement with a $6,000 check, none of my own money in that deal, $1.6 million asset that's going to cash flow over time, appreciate, long-term hold. You know, it's just a great, great thing to add to the balance sheet. Do you have any questions on that? Because we can break down.
I got it. I mean, it's amazing. I guess you have to really be in the field like you to know how to ask these things. Like, you know what to say to a commercial lender as opposed to like them telling you. That's the difference. So people would have to, I don't know, take courses or learn.
It can be, it might sound super complex, and my brain is complex. I like to think of this as like a puzzle. Like, I get excited putting these deals together, because even if I have the money to put in the deal, I would much rather spend some time thinking and figuring out a way to put none of my own money in, just to see if I can do it. And the main reason is, if every asset that I purchase is based upon how much money I have and my credit and my income, then it's my purchasing power is limited. When you train your brain to structure deals like this, your purchasing power is unlimited, because that same example could be used on a $16 million building, a $20 million building. Right. Obviously, there's different parameters and things, but generally speaking, these are not overly complex things to underwrite, because most of the commercial banking is, they have little nuances here and there, but it's generally just a few things. An appraisal. Mm-hmm. Right. So do I really believe the property is going to appraise? Well, this one I bought for $1.6 million. It appraised for $1,625,000. So cool. Instant 25K equity. That's not much to write home about, but if you get the whole deal package with no money in. Okay, so appraisal, you have to have the right DSCR coverage, which that's why I mean a DSCR loan, debt service coverage ratio loan. They can be underwritten differently, but typically what they're going to do is they're going to say, you know, the debt service coverage ratio loan needs to be between a 1.2 and maybe a 1.25. That's kind of general. Usually not much less than that, usually not much more than that. Does vary on asset class and the lender's risk exposure in that market and what they, you know, how they underwrite it. But that 1.2 ratio, all that really means, Jen, is if the property's bringing in, I'll use a $100,000 property. Let's say it costs $1,000 a month for principal, interest, taxes, and insurance. Mm-hmm. Then they want to see 1.2, $1,200 a month in rent.
Okay.
And the thought process behind this is if it's going to cost you $1,000 a month to maintain this property, then you want to make sure there's a spread above that.
Right.
So it's going to cash flow and the property is going to cover the debt. So again, the debt service coverage ratio. So between the appraisal, the debt service coverage ratio loan, Mm-hmm. And then the loan to value. Okay. And the loan to value is just based upon the appraisal. How much will they lend you? So the more they'll lend you, it's going to increase that debt service, meaning mm-hmm. your payments of what it's going to cost to cover it. And the one factor I did leave out in that simplification of the understanding of that is a lot of the banks are going to, they're going to bake in, 5% vacancy, 5% management, 5% CapEx, right? Or I'm sorry, maintenance and repairs, vacancy and management. And okay. So I typically take 15% off the top of the rent mm-hmm. with that DSCR coverage, you know, figuring out how much is the mortgage going to be. So I'd take that $30,000 loan they gave me, put that into an amortization schedule. I can't do the math in my head. And I look at what the principal interest will be, add in the taxes and insurance, mm-hmm. and is this thing really going to cover it, right? So, but bottom line, 120% of the expenses is what the rent needs to equal.
Okay.
It's not that complex. And this is really what I've seen the same on, you know, mm-hmm. a duplex versus a 16 unit. And again, it's going to change a little bit, but that's, if anyone's listening, you know, you can research this stuff. It's not that complicated to figure out. And the point is, once you understand how these are underwritten, then you mm-hmm. can make your offers and structure the deal so that the bank's going to accept it.
Okay. And then you said you had a third one.
Yeah, the third one was my most recent purchase. I guess it was about 3 weeks ago. That was the $3.2 million building, and that's a 16 unit. Okay. So it's about $200,000 per unit, which is in this area. It's actually a pretty good deal. The way I structured that was actually similar to the second one, mm-hmm. but this one I did actually have to write a check for about $300,000 mm-hmm. on a $3.2 million asset. That's about 10% in. And when I said I used basically none of my own money, well, I sold one single property mm-hmm. that I had used, and I used private money to get that. I had no money in that deal. So I just rolled that one into the 16 unit. So I traded a single for a 16 unit.
Okay.
But I'd structured it very similar, where I used first position DSCR loan, second position seller financing. And the one thing that I left out, which is really powerful tool, is the cost of capital. So on both the first one and the second one, or the two examples I just gave you, the $1.6 million mm-hmm. deal and the 2.2, on both right. of those, able to negotiate extremely low interest rates on the second position mortgage in return for okay. giving the seller their sale price. Right okay. now, the markets, you know, we're coming out of people having, high expectations for the sale price based upon
right.
previous years when money was cheaper. Well, money's right. more expensive now. So mm-hmm. if you want me to give that full sale price, you got to work with me on the terms, because the seller is taking back a big chunk of the deal. Mm-hmm. And the way I look at it is, I'm getting an asset that they're selling me, but they're actually putting up the majority of my down payment and closing costs.
Right.
So they're almost like a silent financial partner. I have full control of the deal. Mm-hmm. And they're investing in me and the building. And it's not that hard of a conversation, because they're typically used to having some sort of cash flow from the property. Mm-hmm. They believe the property is a solid asset, right? They're trying to sell it for a premium. So I'm giving them the price they want in return for low interest.
Okay.
That $1.6 million one, mm-hmm. I'm paying 1% interest for the first year, 2% for the second year, 3% for the third year, 4% for the fifth year. Fourth, so 1 through 5, right? Graduating 1% a year. You get the gist of it. And the power in that is, I'm getting my cost of capital so low in an environment where the typical interest rate could be 6.5 to 7.5 on this right. type of commercial asset.
Mm-hmm.
That allows for the payments to make sense. So the exit on this is always, it's a refi within the next 5 years. But I'm very confident that with the rent growth that I'm not expecting market rent growth to be a lot, but okay. I'm I'm already anticipating rent growth based upon the existing market rents and the fact that I'm purchasing these with well below market rents. So all I'm doing is bringing the low market rents that I'm purchasing up to current market rents, utilizing the seller's money that they're selling me the asset and reducing my cost of capital to make the deal work in a market where everyone's saying, hey, none of these deals make sense.
So well, is the seller making money like at once or just over time like you are?
It's based upon how much they owe on it, right?
Okay.
So that's, I think the one that was the 1.6 million, I believe he owed around 800,000.
Okay.
And my first loan was like 1,030,000. So after his closing costs and whatever, you know, he walked away with a chunk of money at settlement.
Okay.
Which he was happy with, but he got to pay off his debt that he had on the property, which was his main concern, paying that off and getting his investor paid back. And then the other portion of it is they're getting paid over time. So there's actually tax benefits for them potentially. That's another negotiation factor, you know, if they're taking the payments over time. But that remaining $480,000 that typically would have been paid to him at settlement, that's now getting paid out over the next 5 years in on an amortized schedule. So, you know, monthly payments, but then at the end of the 5 years, there's a balloon payment. So that's why I'm saying there's an exit strategy on the back end. But I'm confident that it'll appraise for enough that I'll be able to cash him out and the DSCR will still work.
Okay. So that's why he's like also investing in you.
Yeah.
Okay. That's really cool. It's a lot.
Yeah. It's a powerful strategy. And, you know, for any landlords that if you held a property for a long time and you can really like that consistent income, you're not super confident in the stock market or where to put your money, but you like that income. And the benefit is, they're backed by a mortgage that's recorded against the property.
Right.
But guess what, Jen? You never have a tenant call the mortgage company and say, hey, come fix my sink.
Right.
They call the landlord. You never have a tenant or you never have a township call and say, oh, you know, your tenant left trash out and here's a $250 fine. That goes to the landlord.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have someone slip and fall and break their neck and try to sue you for $1 million. You know, and they don't go sue the bank that has the mortgage against the property. So the seller becomes the bank and they get all the benefits of the cash flow. They don't get the appreciation, right? They don't get the equity pay down. They don't get the tax write-offs, but they get the cash flow from the property secured against an asset that they believe in. And in the event of a default, they're in a position where they can take the property back and secure their principal.
Got it. All right. Wow. Do you teach courses in this? You do, right? You have seminars?
I do. So I actually informally have coached and trained a lot of people on creative finance strategies and, you know, between seller financing subject to raising private capital, working with commercial lenders and structuring these loans. But I did just recently start a 100-video course called The Investor Agents. And the investor agent course is really to take people from the full gamut, from the beginning, getting started, you know, goal setting, mindset, to really figuring out what's their alpha. And when I talk about alpha, what's their core competencies and their strengths, right? Someone might not have the same mind that I do for structuring these deals. Well, they can partner with me and go find deals. There may be a relationship builder. There may be a marketer and they can create that deal flow or they're a capital raiser. So I help people define their alpha. You don't have to be great at math. If this was over your head, then don't let that stop you. If you like the idea of this, there's ways to get involved. It's as you get into bigger deals, it is really a team sport and there's a lot of different ways you can bring value. So the investor agent training series really to help people get in, figure out what they're good at, apply their unique strengths to real estate investing, actively invest. And it's really broken down into 100 videos. The first 50 are all about actively investing. And if you think of a football field, that's like get out of the, you know, the defense where you're now on the offense in a sense, right? You're less worried about, you're trying to move things forward. But at some point, you know, when you're investing in real estate, you're going to get kind of burned out of actively investing. And you're going to say, you know what? I don't want to deal with the tenants. I don't want to deal with the townships. I don't want to deal with the toilets. The second half is passive investing as an accredited investor. So that accredited investor status is really like, you know what? I don't want to say you've made it, but you're well on your way to financial freedom. And now you have access to invest in accredited only investments. You know, my fund that I run is a 506C accredited investor. So if you're not an accredited investor, I can't even help you invest that money. Now I help people learn how to invest and I teach them in other ways and we can partner on deals. But for the fund, once people get to that point and you know they've accumulated the assets, they've maximized the assets, and now they just want that passive income and their wealth preservation, passive investing, yeah, maybe the returns aren't as juicy, but you're getting a lot of the upside while minimizing a ton of the downside. I'll be fully transparent. I want deal flow, right? So Jen, I want to teach you how to find these deals because you'll probably come to me and maybe we'll partner on one, or maybe I'll finance the deal for you because I'm a lender, right? So I own a real estate brokerage with 120 local agents that are trained to help people find these deals. Well, we can help a lot of people. It's going to benefit us. But the education piece, I want to put it out there and, you know, help people get this. There will be probably at some point, you know, some sort of, I don't want to say upsell, but the idea is that we will create an inner circle. We have to be, you know, a little cautious about who you bring in because you dilute your time. So, you know, the investor agents is really the active investing, and then the accredited investor agents, they're the capital partners, right? And they're the people that have the money already. And the investor agents are the ones still trying to grow that active side of the real estate business.
How do people find out about your course? It's just from your social media or from your website?
Jen, I'll give you a couple different links. Theaccreditedinvestoragent.com. Mm-hmm. That will take you to a link for the courses. And then you also have theinvestoragents.com, which will take you to my podcast and some other, you know, valuable information for that. Because I've interviewed a lot of real estate investors. There's a ton of content on that as well. And then VRA Capital, which is my fund. And that's for anyone who is an accredited investor already and they want to learn about how we invest that money and you want to become part of the community. You can check out that. And then our website for if you're looking for an investor-friendly agent, so you don't want to learn all this and you want to get to an agent, go to VRA Realty and you submit a contact form. We'll assign you to an agent. We cover PA, Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, and North Carolina. And we'll assign you to someone that already knows this, that can walk you step by step through the whole process.
Okay. And then a couple last questions. That's really cool. All of that information. And I can definitely put it up in my post when I share it with everyone. I wrote everything down. So one other question, like as an investor, why like in an LLC, like do you keep, because sorry, this sounds dumb. Like if you own your house, do you keep your house in like a personal mortgage and then you start a portfolio and that's an LLC? Or is it just like any business?
You know, all right. So number one, the disclosure, not a financial advisor. Okay. Not a PA, and I'm not an attorney. I am a real estate broker, but I'm really just a real estate investor, you know, at heart here. So there's so many different ways to do things. You should probably talk to an attorney about depending on what your goals are and where your assets are. And the reason being is if you're just getting started, one of the best ways to get started is to either house hack, do a live and flip. One of my agents actually has a course on a live and flip. And if you're doing that, sometimes it's better to just take the best financing you can get, which is your primary owner financing, right? For an example, if you do a conventional loan, there's certain products that are as little as, you know, 3% down conventional, and FHA is, you know, 3.5% down, VA is 0% down, USDA 0% down. So there's ways to get into properties for such a small amount of money. And you can get a seller's assist on those. That's not going to work in an LLC, right? Because that's for your own personal, you know, residence. But a lot of those can turn into investment properties. You buy it, you live in it for a period of time, and you move out and you get your next one. So there's different reasons why you would maybe want to start in your own name. But there's a lot of reasons why you want to use LLCs. And the biggest reason is, in my opinion, for asset protection, to segment your personal assets. So that's why I said, you know, if you're just getting started, you don't have a lot of assets. Well, you don't have to be so focused on asset protection. You know, we go through this progression of accumulation, maximization, and then preservation, right? So you're, when you're first getting started, you're focused on just getting your feet wet, getting some deals going. And if you get better financing with lower down payments and better interest rates that are now fixed over 30 years, that's a powerful, you know, deal, especially when the rates were so low. I mean, I had gotten, we got one client a 1.75% interest rate on their primary, you know, at, during COVID times. Now it was a 15-year loan. If the year was in the low twos, though, that is such cheap debt. You would have never got that on commercial loans because the financing's different. But people look at it from an asset protection standpoint and then financing. And the information that I've been giving from attorneys, you know, it's actually, if you really want to get, you know, layers of it, you're going to have multiple LLCs as you scale and grow this. I mean, I believe we're up to somewhere between 15 to 17 different entities that I have. And that's a function of packaging properties. You know, maybe I have stuff in one location in a certain market that's in an LLC. And then I might have a few single families in another area. And then I buy an apartment building. Well, I want that in a separate LLC. You might bring in an equity partner in one. Well, that's going to be a separate LLC, right? So it's really just how you structure the deal.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I'd love to get involved with that. So the knowledge that you've given is, I mean, truly amazing. I took a ton of notes, like it's one of your courses.
And anyone that is, you know, thinking about how to set up the structure, it is worth talking to an attorney, and you should look into like series LLCs. That's a way you can actually have LLCs stack underneath each other. So you don't have to go create, you know, a whole new setup every single time. I mean, it is, there's some administrative benefits to having a series LLC.
Okay, never heard of that either. So you're teaching me things.
What's next? Allows for LLC. I have LLCs in a couple different states.
You said Delaware allows for LLCs?
For series LLCs.
For series LLCs.
There's a few states that do it. And essentially, because an LLC is looked at as really as a third-party entity, right? And every time you create that, now you have a new EIN number, a new bank account. That's it. New bookkeeping for that. And there's administrative for that. And then there's tax returns, right? So there's some downside to having, you know, if you had 100 single family rentals all in their own LLC, to me, that wouldn't make sense. But I know some people that do that.
Right. Yeah.
But maybe you chunked 10 properties in one LLC. Worst case scenario, somehow they pierced, you know, the corporate veil or something. And, you know, the other ones should be segmented. And you're not, like, if you had a catastrophic loss, then that one LLC should be limited to that. That's why it's called a limited liability company, right? So the law can be limited to that company.
Okay. Thank you for that. So what's next for you? Where do you see yourself going and growing?
You know, I've had this real estate brokerage for 10 years. And I'm not proud to admit it. I've never made any money off of it. I've actually lost a decent amount of money. But there's, you know, 120 plus agents and multiple other ancillary businesses that run off of that. And one of the things that I looked at, like, why would you do something for 10 years and you don't get paid for it? Well, you're really passionate about it. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people involved and there's impact. So what I'm ultimately passionate about, it's not the real estate sales. It's not even really the wealth creation. Like I get passionate about the deal structure and the wealth creation, but it's really about the impact that wealth has on people, specifically around abundance. And, you know, the funny thing is we're kind of born with this lack mindset. And I think it's ingrained in us from a survival mechanism of feeling like we don't have enough. And it's a very common theme. If you interview enough people, you know, most people will have at some level, they've felt a time where they don't have enough. Well, money happens to be a major reflection of that because it's something that we use every day. It's our main bartering system, right?
Right.
But it's actually deeper than money. Money is just the illusion of it. And what I like to do is help people along this process of building wealth on the outside, but creating the abundance on the inside. And I think that that's, you know, integrating the two, because it's not like they go hand in hand. And believe it or not, some of the people that have the biggest scarcity mindsets that I've known have the most amount of money.
Have the most amount of money?
You know, like there's not a direct correlation. You know, I've known people that have had $100 million portfolios, and they're afraid to spend $30 on a pair of shoes or buy a water bottle because they can get a free water at a water fountain an hour later, and they don't want to spend the money. You know, so it's balancing that external. Yes, there's the reality of the expenses and stuff, but at some point, which funny enough is you will create wealth, and it's a very common experience where you, no matter what you have, you feel like you still don't have enough. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I'm going in this direction is because I think we need to blend the external with the internal, right? The external success. And I mean, like Tony Robbins, I don't know if I'm going to butcher it, but it's like the science of achievement versus the art of fulfillment. Mm-hmm. And he uses Robin Williams as an example on it. Super successful, massive amounts of achievements, but he killed himself, right? He wasn't fulfilled. And that's what I mean, because I think abundance, that feeling of wealth that we're chasing with the money, you're not going to get it from the money.
Mm-mm.
But I do use the real estate as a vehicle, because I think that it's a very powerful way to create that wealth. And along that pathway, what I've found is I get the most fulfillment from helping shift people's mindset around abundance. And it does go hand in hand with the money once you shift the mindset, because you're willing to take some of these risks. You're willing to believe in yourself. You're willing to trust that there will be enough. Every time, your whole podcast is called, you know, the tagline's like life without a net, right? You know, mm-hmm. So what is that? That's someone taking a leap of faith.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And what allows someone to take a leap of faith is having the abundance mindset that they trust that there will be a net there. There will be something there. You know, we'll be taken care of. We'll figure it out. And that's so, you know, integrating the abundance mindset into the investor agent training course. My passion now is also helping the accredited investor agents, because I just see so many people trying to retire. They think they need so much to retire. And ultimately, they just need that cash flow of whatever their living expenses is. Once you have the passive income that exceeds your living expense, money's not going to really make you that much happier. And if my fund will pay 12% interest, compounding, it's over like 14%. So, you know, if they can get 14% on their money backed by real estate with none of the headaches, I'm solving a major problem.
Right. So what shifted you to get to this? Was it reading books or just how you are, like internally?
I love to figure out how things work. I look at the financial system as a modern day way to control people, right? And that's really sad to me that, you know, when people are going to work 40 years of their life, right? That's on average, work 40 years of their life for money. Why? Just because everyone does that? Because it's a reward system. You know, you get a dog to sit, you give him a treat, and that's how we operate. Well, if you figure out the financial system, ultimately, you know, and look, I'm no economist and I don't know exactly how things work, but big picture, the way I look at this is we're born into this monopoly game of life. And what the government is doing, and it's not just our government, it's most all governments, is they're printing money that's not backed by anything. So money is actually a product, and they just keep adding more product in, and we're trading our valuable time, 40 years of that time, to chase this illusory thing so that we can eventually one day get to go do the things that we really want to do. And when that clicked for me, that I saw I'm in this, it's almost like you're the fish in the fishbowl, and you finally had the insight to realize that you're inside a fishbowl. So once I realized that, I was like, I got to really figure out, how does this whole thing work? And if I'm inside of the game, I need to learn the game. And it's really financial arbitrage. It's borrowing more money and paying it back with debt that's worth less. And I've said that, you know, if you think about, if you pull up usdebtclock.com, whether, you know, things are going blue or red, whether they're going left or right, up or down, economies crashing, you know, stock market soaring. Guess what? That U.S. debt clock doesn't go backwards. And that's a product that's just getting pumped into the system. And if you can, another thing, another data point you can look at is the CPI, right? And you don't even look at like on the short term, look at it on the long term. What is it doing? Well, more than likely history is going to repeat itself and things will look somewhat similar to the past, which has been a decrease in the purchasing power of the dollar. And I'm just happening to use real estate as a vehicle because if you look at different things, if you went to go buy a business, you know, maybe there's some long-term debt on it, but I don't know any long-term debt on businesses. It's usually like 5 years, maybe 10 years. If you go to buy a car, why is it short-term debt? You know, if you get some of these personal loans, like it's a short-term loan, why are they giving long-term loans on real estate asset classes? So for example, it's because the value is going to be there. So right. On a home, it's 30 years. I wouldn't even be surprised, you know, in the past, it was a 15-year loan. I wouldn't even be surprised if they start coming out with like a 40-year amortization. It wouldn't shock me. And mm-hmm. I know that because on HUD loans, on these large apartment complexes, they mm-hmm. are 35, 40-year amortizations, which means you can pay that money back. That last payment will be worth tremendously less. Let's say today your mortgage payment's $1,000, mm-hmm. and what you can buy with $1,000. Think about 30 years from now, what you'll be able to buy with $1,000. You can go to McDonald's, get a cheeseburger.
Right.
But you can make a payment on a mortgage, which is a house that provides the same amount of value. The house didn't even go up in value. The purchasing power of the dollar just went to nothing.
Right.
So your real estate is not the best investment. It only goes up like 2.5% a year on average. Well, stock market, let's say over the last 100 years is 7% average, something like that. Don't hold me to it. Well, that sounds like a much better option. But if I put $100,000 in the stock market, I only get that 7% on $100,000. If I put $100,000 into 10 different real estate deals, because I only need $10,000 up and each one's $100,000 because I got creative with the financial, well, I just bought $1 million worth of assets. And if I can structure that debt where I'm paying it back over a much longer period of time, then I'm getting that yield spread on the difference of what the asset's producing versus the cost of the capital.
Yeah.
So, sorry, you're a good listener. I'm talking way too much, but
I took a million notes. I mean, it's amazing. I definitely want to check out your courses. So how do people get in touch with you? How do you like people to reach out if they want to get a hold of you or talk about a certain deal?
Find me on Instagram, social media, reach out to one of the links, depending on, you know, what you need help with. So, you know, I'd have to limit my time on one-on-one, but depending on what you want, I can help triage and help you get to who you need to go to. I'm really focused on coaching a select few and working with accredited investor agents. So, you know, if anyone's looking to join a real estate brokerage that's friendly for this is, you know, VRArealty.com. If you're looking to passively invest, VRAcapital.com. If you want to check out the investoragents.com or the accreditedinvestoragents.com, those are the links. So I'll have you post them below and they can check out the different avenues of how we can be of service.
Thank you so much. How about that conference? Are you doing that again next year?
That's a great question. We put on the Collaborative Agent Summit. I think we had 187 attendees. We had 26 speakers and we had 16 vendors and it was a ton of work. So we've had so many people reach out, say, hey, are you going to do that again? I would love to. If we get enough people interested, maybe we'll like do a pre-test how many tickets we sell. But ultimately, we would really want to have at least like 400 people at the next event if we're going to do it or not. Right. So it's going to be a big deciding factor on how many commitments we get up front.
Okay, so TBD on that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Stephen. This was like a wealth of information and I can't wait to share it with everyone and hopefully you get a lot of leads from it. So well, thank you again.
I appreciate it. If I can help anyone in real estate, hopefully, you know, the resources we have will be of value.
Well, that's it for now. Thanks everyone for joining us. please reach out to me so I can feature you on my show. I do respond to everyone. You can find me on my Instagram at Jennifer Sherlock or my business Instagram at JennaCom. And check out our new website coming soon, livewithoutanet.com. Thanks again, and I look forward to taking risks with you.